Welcome to Plot Pit, the show where we'll take almost anything and uncover a story within for you to use in your own tale-telling mediums of choice. From novels, novelettes, short stories, poems, songs, scripts for screen and stage, honestly, it doesn't matter. We'll spec something and you might use it. I'm your host, William Atkinson, here in the pit with local author, John LeMay. Hello, John, how you doing?
I'm doing good. It's going to be tough to top that episode we just did, but...
Oh, well, we're going to give it a go. So let's begin the descent. John, you've got two books here. Tell us a little bit about them.
Well, you know, William dredged up the stories last time, so I decided for this one I better bring something to the table. So I've got two books with me. One is The Real Cowboys and Aliens, The Lost Cases, which takes old newspaper articles from the pioneer period, and we kind of look for alien angles to them. And the other book I've got with me, which is the one I'm going to pull from for sure, is UFOs of the Turbulent 30s. And same sort of thing. It's all real or alleged to be real UFO sightings and alien encounters of the decade of the Great Depression. And, you know, we hadn't done 1930s yet on this show. So I thought, well, maybe, you know, we've got some weird stories from the 1930s to pull from this book. And I've got two I'm going to throw out, and then I bet William can pull something from his bag of tricks for the third story to work with. So the primary story, I'm not sure if this is a true story or not. This is one of those articles that people wonder if the quote-unquote reporter just made it up for entertainment. But the story is about a tiny little Inuit village, basically in northern Canada, the frozen north. It was nearby a location called Anjikuni Lake. And again, this story was first published in newspapers in November of 1930, and it told of how a trapper named Joe LaBelle was, wandering through the tundra, and he comes across this Inuit village that he had been to before in the past, and he could see it, you know, illuminated in the moonlight before him, and, you know, knowing these villagers, he knew he could get shelter and some food there, so he goes closer and closer, and to his shock, all the villagers are gone. Everything is there but the villagers, and when we say everything, he literally describes how they had food cooking over a fire, nobody there. There were guns leaning up against the interior of the igloos and the tents, you know. Basically, there were no footprints and there were no people. So where did these people go? And if they went somewhere, would they not have taken their guns and their sled dogs? It's just like Avengers Endgame, where the people just, Thanos snaps them out of existence. These people just disappeared without a trace, you know. And again, in the snow, you should find some footprints and... You know, it's just a very odd little story. And even some of the graves outside the village had mysteriously been exhumed. But again, you know, this story might be completely fabricated and made up. People debate its authenticity to this day. Some of them say there never was a village near Anjikuni Lake. But, you know, for this show, we'll pretend like it really happened. The second story that I dredged up from the 1930s comes from the San Pedro Mountains region of Wyoming, and it involves two gold prospectors in the year 1932. They're tunneling into a mountain, again, in the San Pedros, and they discover this tiny little miniature pygmy mummy. It's basically a humanoid being, only how big was it? I think it was, it's only 6 inches tall, and they have pictures of it. And, you know, you can look at it, and it does kind of look like an alien. It has kind of an odd-shaped head, but it does have a nose like a human being. This thing was fairly well-known. You know, they nicknamed it Pedro because San Pedro Mountains. Today, they can no longer find this mummy, but it did at one time exist. So this is not a made-up story. Many people saw that little mummy, and they did perform tests on it. And skeptics say that it was just a premature infant. That they had mummified, but premature infants don't have full sets of teeth, which this mummy had. So it did seem that this mummy was like a little miniature human being, human adult, only 6 inches high. So, you know, some people connect this mummy to aliens. Some people connect it to the mythical race of little people that all cultures have. But those are my two stories from the 1930s, and the story that William and I concoct doesn't have to be set in the 1930s, but I thought, well, I'll just pick two, and I don't know, do you feel like, William, you have anything to throw in there that might fit this one?
One of the things that my head immediately jumps to is when I was courting my wife, I went to Belarus and was able to visit some of their local museums and national parks and things of that nature. And one of the treats that I was able to enjoy was going to this archaeology site where they had like this dome and they were excavating this old village, and it was a village of little people. And so they had like houses and things, you know, would be for individuals that might have been, I don't know, 24 to 36 inches tall.
Well, now where, yeah, you said the name, but like which state or
so this is Brest, Belarus, just on the border of Poland and Belarus.
Okay. So that's why I never heard of it. So, okay, yeah, cool.
So it's over in Europe, and these houses were small, really small. So I'm guessing that they're little people, you know, from God knows when. I can't remember how old the site was estimated to be, but there you go. So we've got this 6-inch tall pygmy mummy, you said, with full set of teeth. Mm-hmm. And we could be tying into the long lost era of little people that once dominated the surface of the earth.
Yeah. And the thing about little people is little people have always been, and this includes fairies, have always had parallels to modern alien abductions, because they would say that the fairies or little people would take you away. You would have really foggy memories or no memories at all of your encounter with them. With alien abductions, you always have the phenomena of missing time. You know, all of a sudden it's 3 hours later and you don't know where you've been. And then over time, you get these weird flashbacks to your experience. So it was like that in old-timey fairy lore. And, you know, aliens, for lack of a better word, you know, play doctor with the adults. That's a nice way of putting it, I guess, on a podcast. And the fairies did the same thing. They basically played doctor, you know, or in other words, the nature of the encounters had a sexual component to them sometimes. So again, I'm just bringing up the point that fairy lore and alien abductions are actually quite similar.
My head goes a little bit to the will-o'-wisp idea, right? Where you've got this Alaskan village or the village up in a Great White North, our northern neighbors in Canada, and the inhabitants suddenly disappear. The Will-O-Wisp, if you remember the Disney film Brave, right, one of the things that they were known to do was kind of like lure you off into the forest or whatever. They were tricksters. Okay. So we could have a situation kind of that alien abduction thing, but it's not really aliens. It's just kind of along that whole fairy tale world.
Yeah.
And we've got time period of ancient Earth where it was dominated by the Lord of the Rings fantasy world dwarves. Okay. So you've got a bunch of stout little people all over the world. And you've got mythical creatures like, I don't know, elves and fairies. And, okay. So now we're in the fantasy world. So a village in the Great White North before Ice Age, okay? Mm-hmm. I mean, it could be during the middle of the Ice Age if we wanted to. And the Will-O-Wisps don't like these pioneers, there we go, colonizing all over their forest.
Yeah.
They're cutting down the trees.
I like it. See, your mind went exactly where I wanted it to, which is instead of doing the alien route, because aliens are kind of overdone, and we did aliens last episode too, but that's why I picked those two stories was, okay, the little people, which includes the little mummy from the San Pedro Mountains, the little people whisked these Inuit natives off to the fairy realm or whatever, and that's how and why they disappeared.
So we could stay on that time period with the fairy tale creatures, the fairy tale inhabitants in that time period of Earth. Or we could craft a prelude using that backdrop. And then we have an archaeologist that shows up on the scene, and he's actually, or she is actually, discovering that all of these old legends were indeed actually true.
Yeah, that's right. They could actually find the Anjikuni Lake Village they claim didn't exist, and they proved that the story was true, and then the San Pedro Mountains mummy is just kind of like ancillary evidence of the little people, and because that's how I feel. It doesn't have to be 1930s, but just, you know, both stories do come from that decade.
Now, with the 1930s, we are looking at, say, Prohibition in the United States, so we could have a undercurrent of organized crime and mafia activity and an overzealous government with the police force trying to keep all of that down. And somehow our hero or heroine is exposing all of these ancient legends, gets mixed up with one side or the other, both being the, on the wrong side of the intellectual or scientific community's desired outcome. The mafia is looking to exploit it from the fact of, say, magical fairy dust and all of this other stuff.
Oh, I like it.
Okay. And they're trying to figure out how to exploit the magic end of the ancient world. And then, say, the FBI, who's trying to squash out the mafia, are also going kind of, you know, so we're building up into World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you've got this buildup of the intelligence community, and from the government conspiracy aspect, if you want to lay that on top of this, we could have the CIA, or the prelude to the CIA, trying to squash any knowledge of the ancient world.
I like that. Yeah, I love that you went with the gangsters and the FBI, because that gives it such a fresh angle, again, as opposed to aliens or whatever. That's totally from out of left field, but it fits and it's cool. I like it. I like this.
So we could have a Pulp Fiction Dick Tracy type feel.
Yeah, and maybe, you know, since it's like a Dick Tracy type, he or she has several missing persons that he doesn't realize were whisked off to the fairy realm. And then, like you said, somehow we also work the mafia into that and the government. And yeah.
Okay. We have this mummy that later disappears. We lose track of it. It still exists.
Historically speaking, it disappeared in like the 1950s. But I mean, in our story, you know, it could be like the MacGuffin that disappears right away, you know.
Sure. What you could end up having is these fairy tale creatures are still living with us,
mm-hmm.
and they live outside of our dimension. And when our heroine or hero discovers this pygmy mummy,
mm-hmm.
they don't like that.
Yeah.
And so they snatch him back. And so now what you've got is kind of three groups of antagonistic forces all trying to squash any type of knowledge or exploit knowledge of mm-hmm. the ancient world's magical underpinnings.
That is cool. And then you made me click on something else, you know, if we're going with 1930s, that's right on the end of the 1920s, and the 1920s had a big time occult spiritualist movement for a while. So, yes. I mean, that could play in somewhere. I don't know how, but somehow it could.
We certainly do have a lot of those stories. One that pops into my head, do you remember the Stephen King film or book, Rose Red?
No, you'll have to.
So it's a haunted house that, so here, the basic premise of the movie was a made-for-TV three-part miniseries kind of thing. And it's a haunted house in basically downtown Seattle, where the starting of the construction is somewhere in the early 1900s. So going into, say, the 1910s, 1910s, 1920s, somewhere in there. And the house was born evil.
Mm-hmm.
And the premise is basically the house is just gobbling up souls, right? And it morphs and changes itself. It's a classic horror, haunted house type thing. But you were talking about the spiritualist movement. Stephen King kind of hits a little bit on that. So we could have some form of going back to episode 2 with the clairvoyant article out of the Santa Fe Gazette, September 25th. Santa Fe Weekly Gazette, you've got this clairvoyant or savant who's located in San Francisco, I presume. At least the San Francisco Chronicle's the one that reported this. The Santa Fe Weekly Gazette picked it up and reprinted it. We have this savant claiming that an earthquake is about to happen on the West Coast. And here we have in the 1930s, so the time periods aren't quite right, but we've got this underpinning of 1920 spiritualism movement. We've got some form of clairvoyance talking about, I don't know, earthquakes or planetary alignments and magical powers of the ancient past. Could be a street preacher. People think he's nuts.
Street preacher. Now I get what you're saying now, because they used to have those, which we don't really have today. Day as much, I guess, but yeah, back then that was more of a thing, huh?
Well, certainly not here. I have been to Washington D.C. and they're out there.
Okay,
yeah. So you still have like the major cities. You still have some street preachers and such. But yeah, we could have a clairvoyant who is trying to get people's attention, and there's a chance encounter with this street preacher and our archaeologist.
Mm-hmm.
So we could end up with two protagonists in this story.
Yeah, and they could have clashing ideologies of faith and skepticism and what have you, and that's how that what makes their interactions interesting.
One's scientifically minded, the other is spiritually minded.
Yeah.
A classic odd couple.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm really liking the gangster angle. There's probably some mobsters that were into the occult that we're just going to miss this episode, and we'll learn about them later and be like, oh man, we could have used them in this story. But, you know, somebody out there listening, you know, you can Google that and be like, oh, what was a mobster who was into the occult in the 1930s? Because I'm sure there was one, and that could probably be the villain of the piece, and he's trying to do something with Fairyland and all that. And Fairyland is a real thing. There's a couple of different names for it in our real mythology. Some people call it Etheria. Some people call it Magonia. Magonia, that's where that movie Magnolia with Tom Cruise came from. Okay. That's an allusion to Magonia, the land of the fairies, and they just called it Magnolia.
So let's create a mobster that's into the occult.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, what is the mobster's goal? Does he want to hide his stolen goods in Magonia, which seems a little oversimplified for an evil plot? Or does he want to take some of the magic from Magonia and use it to rule the world, or use it to get rid of the FBI, what have you?
I wouldn't imagine the mobs trying to control the world or dominate from that perspective. That was never really the underpinning of the organization. It was always about business and money, right? And I would think that they want to exploit the magical aspect of the ancient world in such a way as to further their financial position. And obviously, I'm sure the mobster would want to take out a couple of federal agents.
Yeah.
What does that mean? Do we want to go kind of the comic route, or do we want to go the more serious route?
I think whenever you deal with something this outlandish, you know, I think that's where Marvel succeeds. They don't take themselves too seriously. So, I mean, this whole concept is so outlandish. I think it's got to be maybe not comical as a whole, but have comical moments that fit the story. That's probably what I would say.
So we could have comic relief of the story come into play from the mob.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that too. And then I was thinking too, you know, maybe the mob is after a special flower or something or plant in Magonia, and they can use it to make a new medicine or drug. A drug is probably better because drugs are nefarious. So they have a plant in Magonia and they want to make a new drug out of it and sell that drug.
Okay. We have an Al Capone type who's chaotic and not particularly savvy in terms of our strategy.
Mm-hmm.
More of a break the door down and ask questions later as opposed to strategizing and figuring out a intellectual means.
Yeah.
Okay. But if he's trying to create a drug from the special flower, there has to be a legend that he is aware of. Where would he find that legend?
I think somebody's going to find that on Google as they listen to this. Because like I said, William and I, the fun for us is we make this up on the spot. So sometimes that's good. Like right now, I feel like we might have benefited a little bit more from like doing some pre-research and stuff. But again, you know, somebody out there, you can probably find a real legend about a fairy flower or something that they're going to use. I unfortunately don't have that in my memory banks. I have a lot of weird stuff up there, but fairies I'm not super sharp on.
We could go with the old adage of a black lotus.
Oh, okay.
That would be the flower.
Yeah.
Right? Now, you would find it, I would think, ooh, here we go. We could tie it into the Vatican.
Yeah, that too, yeah.
There's untold treasures of old books in the Vatican libraries.
Well, and there's lots of Catholic mobsters, actually. So, I mean, there's that too.
Yeah, we could have a Catholic priest who can't keep his mouth shut, who inadvertently, so kind of going along with the kind of comic aspect of this, right? So happens to share the same name as one of the cardinals that invitations to some fancy party gets mixed up in the mail, okay? And this Catholic priest ends up going to the Vatican, stumbles into the old archives and everything, pulls out these old legends of the untold past, brings it to his parish,
mm-hmm.
and is preaching at the pews, or, you know, at the pulpit. Well, not the pulpit, the altar, I think is what the Catholics call it. And you've got the mobster there who picks up on this.
Good. That's good. Good
so
tracking.
Kind of a bungling random chance sort of scenario. And then the mobster's like, yeah, this is, you know, cuckoo. And mm-hmm. then goes home and reads in the paper of this mummy.
Yeah.
And the village where the archaeologist says all these people suddenly mm-hmm. vanished. And this would kind of tie into, say, the legend of the flower that attracts will-o'-wisps.
Ooh, okay, that's cool.
So it's the spawning flowers or the mating portals of our will-o'-wisps. Yeah.
And I've got an idea for the ending. It can either be a last ending twist shot, kind of like Raiders of the Lost Ark, or it can be just a twist to the climax where the bad guys are fighting. So my thought is, okay, the heroes finally subdue the mob, and they think, okay, we beat the bad guys, we beat the mobster. Then they find out, again, this could either be part of the climax or it could be the final scene. But the idea is it turns out the government, you know, the FBI was also evil, and they're going to take this flower now and do even worse things than the mob ever did with it. And that could either be the epilogue of the story in the movie, like I said, like Raiders, where it's carted off to the secret warehouse, or it's just another aspect of the climax where you have a twist that, oh, we thought this FBI agent, he was a good guy, but now he's actually the real bad guy and we've got to defeat him before the story ends and, you know, that sort of thing. That's where my mind is going.
Okay, yeah. So piggybacking off of that, I'm thinking that our mobster friends was just phase one.
Mm-hmm.
And the driving forces behind the mafia are actually benevolent and are trying to keep the FBI from getting their hands on all of these.
Yeah.
Or, because we are talking about the 30s, right, and this buildup geopolitically with Hitler in Europe and World War II, we could be kind of going into the aspect that the Nazis get involved.
Yeah, that too.
And are interested in this for whatever reason.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So now what we've done is we've gone from a Prohibition-era mobster meets fantasy land into a geopolitical global catastrophe, brewing world war, and fate of humanity.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you're interested in writing a trilogy, folks.
Yeah. Yeah, again, like we always say, these are public, I mean, these are real articles that are now in public domain for the most part, so it's not like our idea. We just took these real existing properties and sewed them together, and, you know, you can do the same thing and have fun with it.
If you're at all interested in role-playing, right, this is where a lot of our stories from Dungeons & Dragons or Call of Cthulhu or whatever comes from, is, you know, just trying to piece these things together from disparate sources and weaving together something that actually sounds interesting. So the hope of this show is to inspire our listeners in creating stories from a variety of different sources.
Yeah, and I mean, they're even tempting for me to flesh out and write, but I've already got a series I do called 21 Guns, and I've only done two of them, and it takes like a year to do each one. So, I mean, I'm not going to get to any of these, so, but they're really cool ideas.
And you want to write 21 books.
Yeah, like I said, I've done two of the, so I've got 19 to go. And they're very similar to this, taking real things, but mine are very Southwest set, you know, so this is fun, you know, because we went to Alaska. We did the 1930s and gangsters and mobsters and the FBI and fairies. I don't play with any of that in my book. So this is like very refreshing. It's a good creative exercise for me. So I appreciate it.
Well, I just enjoy it. You know, the conceptualizing of the story, I think, is a lot of fun. So, folks, we have an abandoned village or nefariously disappeared. We have a very small mummy with a full set of teeth, which also mysteriously later disappears, and mobsters, clairvoyance, spiritualism movement, the Nazis. I mean, you could take this in any particular way that you want. All sorts of fun storytelling. And if you have something that you are willing to share and this show has inspired you at all, send it to submissions@plotpit.com. Until next time, you've been listening to Plot Pit.